Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
The farm operating interest rates, if the inflation is not as tight, we're probably looking at a little bit lower operating interest rates, because usually you're looking at the real interest rate, you know, being positive, obviously. And so if there's not as much inflation pressure, there's not as much pressure for the operating interest rates to be high.
It's a discussion that's happening on many farms right now. Dr. Michael Langemeyer is with the Purdue Center for Commercial Agriculture talking about possibilities of higher inflation.
So if the Fed's forecasts are right, we're probably looking more like the 6% or maybe slightly under. If there's more inflation, then we're looking at something 6.5, even higher, if there's higher inflation.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, farmers and producers stand ready to play their part in conservation. Attrition in on-the-ground staff has reduced landowners' opportunities to learn from trained technical assistance providers who provide site-specific solutions to implement conservation practices effectively.
Representative Abigail Spanberger from Virginia is the chair of a House Ag Subcommittee on Conservation.
Consider this. Between 2004 and 2019, staffing levels at NRCS have declined 24%. Unlike many other federal agencies, nearly all NRCS staff, or 98%, are located outside of Washington, D.C. And as such, attrition in NRCS's ranks is felt disproportionately by those who are seeking to implement conservation practices on their land. Farmers are the original conservationists and play a critical role in helping to safeguard our environment. In 2018, Congress reaffirmed the importance of voluntary, incentive-based conservation in the Farm Bill by maintaining robust funding in the conservation title. Moving forward, it is critical that Congress adequately fund technical assistance at NRCS to ensure the effective implementation and to maximize accountability of these voluntary programs. However, while increasing funding can help reduce attrition within the conservation workforce at NRCS, it does not reach the underlying issue of the conservation workforce shortage. Instead, I have heard directly about the fierce competition between state agencies, nonprofit technical service providers, and NRCS for the same small number of specialists in communities across my district and the country. In order to meet the needs of farmers, it is essential that we do more to attract more young Americans into this field and grow the size of this essential workforce. Today, I am excited to hear from our witnesses who are working to build this pipeline, starting from K-12 all the way through community colleges and land-grant universities.
Now, the ranking member is a rice farmer from Northern California, Representative Doug LaMalfa.
We're talking about in the Farm Bill, we're going to have a heavy lift next year getting that done, so I'm glad we're getting ahead of it with hearings on many aspects. Title II of the Farm Bill provides farmers, ranchers, and landowners with a variety of programs and tools to engage in voluntary incentive-based conservation activities. Some of them work very well right here in Rice Country where I live. These management activities address various natural resource concerns and are really a win-win for both the producer as well as environmental needs, as the benefits to both are indeed well-established. Under the 2018 Farm Bill, the Conservation Title provides over $6 billion in funding for these programs each year. This funding supports working lands programs such as the EQIP, the CSP, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program also. Supports non-working lands such as the CRP program and the Ag Conservation and Easement Program. In my home state of California, we continue to see the value of voluntary conservation and the great need for increased land management. Conservation activities and active management directly improve water and soil quality, encourage wildlife habitat, and can help restore forest lands after wildfires, something we desperately need as the fires in this area are in a six-digit range in acres. The Dixie Fire alone, just under 1 million last year. 1 million acres. We're far behind on this. So I hope that these programs, as well as the increased employment, can kick in and really help get us fast forward on putting these lands back to something I think the American people would like. So, indeed, wildfires and crisis this year already. We had several fires in the open space areas just in my district last yard. Thankfully, they're not in the forest yet, but with the north wind and such, it's indeed a threat all the time. And I hold my breath as to what's coming here later this year.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Everybody does things just a little bit differently, and that's the case whether you're looking at one small specific region of the country or you expand that scope out to encompass the entire nation.
Tanner Beamer is Senior Director of Government Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Everybody does things a little bit differently, and it has been a very eye-opening experience. You know, next month I'm coming up on 5 years at the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and during that time I think I've traveled to about, probably 30-ish states to meet with cattle producers and talk about their issues. And, you know, I always tell folks up on Capitol Hill when I'm meeting with them about these issues, you know, I grew up in this industry, and there's not a day goes by that something new doesn't come along that I'm learning for the first time. It's really kind of a cool opportunity, and it's really important in helping me keep a good perspective as we're lobbying for some of these priorities.
Beamer talks about how the staff navigates issues, especially of markets, in Washington, D.C.
Over the course of the last couple of years, you know, cattle markets have been first and foremost on the minds of those of us in Washington, D.C., both on Capitol Hill and downtown. And our ability to bounce ideas off of our affiliates and get the unique perspectives of the different parts of the country has been instrumental in our ability to navigate a pretty tricky issue in a way that is inclusive of everybody's different viewpoints and perspectives, and of course adheres to our policy that was adopted by our members through our policymaking process.
And while it's popular to come up with legislative fixes for problems, says it doesn't always hit the bullseye.
The House Agriculture Committee several weeks ago did a hearing where they examined concentration in the packing sector. And that was a very long and drawn out conversation. And I think if my math is correct, that would actually be the seventh hearing that we've had in all of Congress during the 117th Congress on this issue. So it has been paid very close attention to over the past couple of years. And earlier this week, the House Ag Committee voted to advance a piece of legislation called the Meat and Poultry Special Investigator Act, which NCBA is opposed to. What the bill would do is it would create an Office of the Special Investigator at USDA to examine competition matters amongst the major meat packers. And that is good. You know, NCBA supports robust enforcement of the Packers and Stockyards Act. We want to make sure everybody's playing above board. But we are opposed to this legislation because there already is an agency at USDA that is charged with enforcing the Packers and Stockyards Act and looking at competition matters. It's called the Packers and Stockyards Division, and it's been around in some form or fashion for over 100 years. And so this piece of legislation really doesn't create anything new at USDA. The only thing it would do is it would give a government official very broad unilateral authority to bring civil lawsuits. That's really the only new power that this legislation grants to USDA. In the meantime, the Packers and Stockyards Division is charged with enforcing the act in its entirety. They have a dedicated competition branch to look at these issues. However, in 2021, of all of their workload that they engaged in, only about 1% of those were classified as competition matters. So why we need to have a special investigator for that, it really defies logic. And then just to put an icing on that cake, the bill is unfunded, which means there's no dedicated pot of money for that special investigator's office. And if it were to pass on the Senate side or the full House of Representatives and be signed into law, that new office would have to compete for already scarce resources across other critical mission areas at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So this is a solution in search of a problem. It's redundant, it's duplicative, and ultimately, our big concern, Tony, is that it's going to result in less effective enforcement of the Packers and Stockyards Act.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This is from March 21 to March 22. The latest available information from USDA is March 2022. As we get the new information from April in a couple weeks, I'll update this chart. And obviously, there's been a lot of volatility and basically a surge in farm input prices.
Dr. Michael Engemeyer is with the Purdue Center for Commercial Agriculture.
You know, the PCE deflator off to the far left there is 6.6%. You know, you look at that chart and say, well, that looks relatively low. That's very high inflation. It's just that some of these farm input prices have just skyrocketed. Anhydrous, 145%, potash, 94%, diesel, 76%. That diesel's actually going to go up. We've seen actually higher diesel prices recently, so that's actually going to go up. And even the supplies, machinery, buildings, and materials, 14 to 23%, those are huge increases. And so this chart just does a nice job of illustrating the large increases we've seen in most of the farm inputs. And in most cases, farm input prices have increased more than the PC deflator. And that's not real surprising because some of farm inputs follow general inflation fairly closely. Things like fertilizer, seed, chemicals do not. They have their own market fundamentals.
And Langemeyer talks about why interest rates matter.
One of the reasons we're talking about this is inflation's a key to both farmland, but also farmland, because farmland is a hedge against inflation, but also interest rates, obviously. And so let's review where interest rates have been recently. Looking at April 22 data, that's the latest data available. Federal funds rate was only 0.33%. The 10-year Treasury was 2.75%. The 10-year Treasury is more something that we compare to real estate rates, whereas the Fed fund rate and the prime rate is more to operating loan rate. The prime rate was 3.5%. In early May, the Federal Reserve increased the Fed fund rate about 0.5% or half a percent. That gets us up to about 0.8-0.9% for the Fed fund rate. The 10-year Treasury increased to over 3% in early May, and the prime rate went up to 4%. Based on what the news from the Federal Reserve Board, they're expecting the prime rate or the Fed rate. Fed funds rate to increase another percentage. That would add a percent to the prime rate, moving that towards 5% if that does happen. The question that Jim asked me this morning, we actually added this to the slide, what does this mean for farm operating interest rates? Well, there's not a direct link between the prime rate and the operating interest rates, but they do tend to move together. And so if we saw a 1.5% increase in the operating interest rate from April, for example, we would be looking at operating interest rates from 6 to 6.5%. That sounds really high, but that's about where we were pre-COVID. If you look at 2018, 2019, Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, the interest rates were right around 5.756%. So we're going back to where we were pre-COVID. Again, the Federal Reserve Board does not look at forecasting the prime rate. Rather, they look at the Fed funds rate. And so we can apply what the increases in Fed funds rate, what that might be doing to other interest rates, because this is a fundamental interest rate that people look at from a forecast standpoint. They're expecting that funds rate to go up to 1.9%. That'd be the 1.5% increase in 22. That's where I'm getting the 6 to 6.5% operating interest rate. And then they're expecting another percentage increase as we move into 23. Longer run, they're expecting that Fed funds rate to be 2.4%. And so if this all materializes, that means operating interest rate is not heading to 4% anytime soon. We're looking more at like 6%, 6.5% long run.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You have to assume that within Ukraine, I mean, they're going to have supply constraints across all kinds of inputs.
Dr. Mark Jekinowski is chief of the World Ag Outlook Board, talking about high fertilizer cost.
You know, within the U.S., for example, do fertilizer prices play a role? Well, no, I would argue that perhaps for high fertilizer prices were behind that relatively smaller acreage intentions for corn that we saw relative to what I think a lot of people had expected, seeing higher corn acreage because of the corn soybean price ratio, et cetera. So at least indirectly in that case, if high input costs, high fertilizer costs are driving producer expectations and producer plans for what they intend to plant this year, that's how the fertilizer cost would have factored into the WASDE. But then, of course, globally with other countries, every country on a case by case basis. I mean, we have to make judgments and assumptions on yield and fertilizer costs, input costs, along with weather and everything else is just one of those. One of the ingredients in those assessments and those models that come into play in either, some years are going to have a bigger effect. Other years, when supplies are flowing normally, we might not care as much. But certainly, overall, globally, sure, I think high fertilizer prices and tight supplies are likely showing up in the production forecasts in one way or another.
Jackanowski, in a recent roundtable with USDA chief economist Dr. Seth Meyer.
So you talked about planting intentions. Just for our audience, that's kind of, you know, I always think about that when you're, you know, you're buying a house and there's a negotiation. The March 31st planting intention is really like the beginning of the bid ask, right? You know, the farmers are saying, hey, at those prices, here's what I'm going to plant. And the market has some response back and forth. So you don't see the rest of the negotiation until when? When do you start to incorporate new information?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, you know, we look at this every single month. I mean, we look at the, everything that we look at the weather, we look at planting progress each month, so we could make adjustments. But the next real kind of official guidance in terms of, the production side of the balance sheet and what likely got planted will come on June 30th with the NASA June acreage report. So that's when NASA actually goes out, follows up with those farmers or a similar sample of farmers to ask them at that point. Planting is, it's wrapping up if it isn't completed in its entirety by early to mid June. So that's when NASA is collecting information from them on what they planted. They will put that in the report that comes out June 30th, and then we will use those acreage estimates in our July WASD, and that will form the basis of what we view as the supply side of the balance sheet going forward. Ultimately, later in the year, adjusted with the NASA yield forecast and objective yield surveys and whatnot. But our next real look at the acreage, what was planted, that will come June 30th.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
It's crowded space when you talk about predicting where food is going.
Hurt Blades is Senior Vice President of Ag with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers on a recent report.
So the question comes up a lot. Why is AEM entering into this same category where a lot of people are trying to talk about what trends are happening within agriculture? We felt it was really important for us to kind of create an industry position. So we did. We pulled together about 20 different companies and executives and futurists from those different companies in the ag space to really hone in on those, you know, those issues that are really driving everything that they're doing today. And it was kind of an open-ended sheet. What started as an exercise when we had a blank sheet of paper, we kind of turned that into really a structured conversation where we started with, you know, say 50 different trends and boiled them down to the ones that have the biggest impact. We did this really just to put our position out there, but also to spur the conversation with regulators and policymakers that are out there, you know, coming up with ideas of how to feed the world. We want to make sure that farmers' voices are appropriately heard.
But when wading off into the waters of uncertainty, Representative David Scott, chairman of the House Ag Committee from Georgia.
I want to remind you all that a while back, as I was serving not as chairman, but chairman of the Credits and Energy and the Exchanges Subcommittee, that I, along with then Chairman Colin Peterson and Mike Conaway, who was also chairman, and my friend Austin Scott, we led a fight then to preserve the sanctity of our clearinghouses. There was a threat that the EU wanted to regulate them. We had to step in and stop that. So this is why this is very critical as we look at this. And both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans, were very concerned about that. We have the greatest financial system in the world, as I said, and we must ensure that the CFTC's regulatory safeguards governing derivatives markets help us maintain that position in the future. That's why this hearing is important.
And it's on the topic of allowing Bitcoin to set up exchanges that could be used for ag.
As you know better than anyone, Chairman Scott, you and this committee have spent enormous time, you mentioned it in your opening remarks, and energy defending the CFTC standards and regulatory oversight as equal to or better than any other jurisdiction in the world. If, in fact, the CFTC decides to approve a rushed and ill-conceived proposal, we believe the hard-won cross-border equivalence agreement that you refer to could come under question.
Terry Duffy is CEO of the CME Group in Chicago.
Just a few weeks ago, sir, a senior European Central Bank official warned, and I quote, "The crypto market is now larger than the subprime mortgage market was when it triggered the global financial crisis." To put this into context, the subprime mortgage market was at $1.8 trillion in 2008. Today, the cryptocurrency value is north of $1.8 trillion and growing. The stakes are extremely high. Exempting FTX from a well-established U.S. clearing rules can undermine confidence in our regulatory regime. Therefore, I applaud you, Mr. Chairman, and this committee for holding this hearing today. Your oversight of the derivatives marketplace structure is critical to ensuring sound public policy.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You are correct as far as looking at the overall conditions throughout the High Plains and Southern High Plains. We are definitely drier at this snapshot point in time than we relatively were even in 2011.
Cody Besant is CEO of Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers.
And that's where a lot of folks really have that recoil or recall of how that year transpired for the growing season. But fortunately, we're kind of catching up a little bit. Certainly this recent rains will help with some of the dry land planting conditions and help with the irrigated conditions as well, just trying to get a stand as we continue forward. But that being said, we do need to have some additional timely rainfall for this year's crop to be a pivotal one. And we are way behind the eight ball as far as normal growing conditions or normal rainfall conditions. To the point, visiting with several producers just south of the Lubbock area, you know, they're to the point of 8 to 10 inches of deficit compared to where they are normal of an average rainfall. So a lot of legwork to catch up on. And people are just mindful. We're in non-ideal conditions relatively as it looks at from just agronomic and planning due to a lack of rainfall or moisture. But also it's just a very challenging year. We certainly have good pricing conditions, but coupled with that, we have higher input costs. And so there's a lot of uneasiness within the countryside, per se, of how this year will transpire. But certainly as rainfall continues, and we are very hopeful that that will, people will be able to make a good crop and be able to price it for a good marketing place as well.
Looking at conditions across the entire Cotton Belt, he says.
So kind of going west to east on the far west out through California, Arizona, they're certainly seeing very dry conditions, much like we are seeing. Maybe not as severe drought type conditions, but it is very dry, you know, relative to where they have been. So, you know, we do believe some of their acres probably will be a little bit down in certain areas as they supplement that with a different type of crop. As you get through the Delta area, so on toward east of Texas and on through the Mississippi Delta, they relatively had decent rainfall. They've been planting and getting some pretty decent stands. And even in some cases, they've had too much rainfall where they can't get into the field, especially through that kind of Louisiana area where they've had some really nice showers that have been a little bit overabundant for there. As you get on further to the East Coast, they're relatively adequate as far as growing conditions right now. They'll just need some more supplemental rainfall as they move throughout the growing season. So really kind of the hot spots as far as the challenge we're seeing right now in the overall cotton growing belt is in the heart of Texas and Oklahoma, Kansas, and in Arizona and California as we go forward. So overall, the U.S. is going to make cotton. Now, how much is still relative and to be determined, but there are some good spots throughout the entire cotton belt across the U.S.
And with a slightly different view, Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA.
Taking a look at the cotton planting progress for the week ending May 22nd, producers planted 17% of the crop during the week, moving past the halfway mark to 54% by the 22nd. That is ahead of the five-year average of 51%, even further ahead of last year's 47%. We see California finishing Cotton planting early this year, 100% planted. Five-year average is 87%. And Texas, our number one production state, right on par, 44% planted, equal to the five-year average.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Since the 1930s, NRCS has provided producers with technical support and financial assistance to achieve the benefits of a healthy and productive landscape.
Virginia Representative Abigail Spanberger.
In 2019 alone, NRCS and its partners worked with more than 500,000 producers, a half a million producers, on more than 43 million acres to build conservation plans and implement practices that increase production, reduce input costs, conserve natural resources, and protect wildlife habitat. Together, these actions not only have a positive impact on farms, but also on their neighbors, their watersheds, and the entire U.S. population through well-documented environmental benefits, including improved water quality through the reduction of runoff, increased resilience of the land against drought in dry years, and reduced carbon dioxide emissions in the environment through the sequestration of carbon from healthier soils.